You know, I want to go into the price of gas. And not just the price of gas, just what's going on with gas. Let's start with the general view. Europe was always $2, $3, $4 ahead of us. When gas was $3 a gallon here, Europe was $6, $7 a gallon. And, oh, my God, that's horrible. You know, how do you drive in Europe? Guess what? We're right up there. Most countries in Europe, as a matter of fact, the gas is cheaper than it is here. Far cheaper. A little bit more expensive in Amsterdam, and, well, that's where it stops, and then Oslo, and then it goes all the way down. You go to Paris, $5.54. London, $5.79. This is U.S. dollars. Tokyo, $4.24 a gallon in U.S. dollars. I mean, in Brazil, $3.12 a gallon. Frankfurt, Germany, $5.57 a gallon. Now, where you really want to drive, and I mean you really want to drive, is in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, where gas is 91 cents a gallon, but then they produce oil, lots of it. This is Cairo, 65 cents a gallon. I'll tell you the best place on the planet to buy gasoline, Caracas, Venezuela, produces its own oil, and the government subsidizes everything. You go down to Caracas, you rent a car, and they ask you, you got to fill it up before you take it back to the airport. 12 cents a gallon for gasoline. There you go. Those are gas prices. In the meantime, well, let's just say, the average price here in California hit $6 a gallon yesterday for the first time. And the analysts at JP Morgan are saying prices, if nationally, could go up to $6 a gallon. If that happens, can we imagine what happens to us? And when did this happen? Well, right after the invasion of Ukraine is when it really started exploding. And there's a reason why they're so expensive here. Even as a result of what happened in Ukraine. We're not affected the most, but let me explain why we're affected more than we should be. First of all, we buy very little oil and gas. I mean, just almost nothing from Russia. But they supply a good chunk of the world's energy. As a matter of fact, in Europe, in some cases, they provide 100% of the oil that's imported into nations right around Russia. And so the world market for oil is pretty high. As a matter of fact, Jen, what is today, and I know you just don't have it at your fingertips, but what is the price of a barrel of oil today?
You think I don't have that at my fingertips, handle, please. Of course I do. So the price of oil is $110.40 a barrel.
Okay, so 110 was higher than that, but that's really astronomically high. And that's because it's a commodity and there's apprehension and there's a reduced amount of oil coming in. So there is, obviously, it affects the world price and affects us. But I'll tell you what else affects us is our exports of oil and gas have gone through the roof. We actually are exporting more, which means we have less. And the reason we have less is not only because we're exporting more, but the number of refineries are down. Some of them were just taken offline because of the pandemic. No one was driving. No one was flying. Trucks weren't being driven across the United States and delivering goods. I mean, everything had ground to a halt, and no one was producing gasoline, didn't have to. And all of a sudden now it came back with a vengeance. And so everything goes up. Here's the question I have, and this is the forecasters. What's going to happen this summer? Are people willing to spend $10 or $6 a gallon for gas or even higher than that? And the other thing, in California, the state's average is $6.02. Who the hell can buy gas at $6.02? You know, they're saying three out of four stations or one out of four stations is $5.75 a gallon or less. Have you seen gas at $5.75 a gallon any place?
No.
The cheapest I have found it is $5.89.
You know where you can go? You can go to our website, KFIAM640.com, keyword gas, and find the cheapest gas prices in your area, handle.
Or you can go to Caracas, and you'll pay 12 cents a gallon for gasoline.
It is crazy.
Yeah, and Caracas is not actually a fun place to go, not these days. Used to be the Paris of South America, Caracas. It was one of the most magical cities in South America. And then Chavez got in, and now Maduro got in, and just ruined the country. I mean, totally destroyed it single-handedly, or in this case, double-handedly, one after the other. California, as you would guess, is one of the most renter-friendly states in the country, if not the most renter-friendly. And within California, there is a city that goes beyond the protections that the state gives, and that happens to be where I live, the city of Los Angeles. No surprise there. Now, rental housing in Southern California has been a landlord's market. We know that. The demand exceeding supply by a long shot. But that doesn't mean the landlords are in Happy Valley either. During the first 2 years of the pandemic, California tenants did not make billions of dollars in rent. Wages dropped, expenses rose, and what the state did, what the city did, what the feds did is they put a moratorium on evictions and various programs to pay both renters and landlords. And one of the reasons they did that was to avoid an epic surge in homelessness. We don't often talk about that. Not only to help people out, but the last thing government wants to do is have people on the street, because therein lies a cost that is astronomical, and we all know that. And when people aren't working, they can't make the rent. It's not that complicated. We're talking about people who have good jobs or had good jobs but couldn't work during the pandemic because they didn't have jobs. So now here we are, a year, 2 years later, and you're still living in the same apartment, same unit, same house, and all of a sudden you owe, I mean, tens of thousands of dollars of rent. Who has that much money? Let's say your rent was $2,500 a month, and for 10 months you couldn't pay it. Well, I mean, there you are right there, 10 months times 2,500, that's $25,000. You're going to write a check for $25,000? And the landlord has the right to toss you out and sue you for $25,000. Well, small claims court, where everybody goes to, has a limit of $10,000 jurisdictionally, right? No, the state changed that when it comes to eviction and suing under these circumstances. So you're screwed on that one, too. And it's very difficult for the renters. So what is going on? Very difficult for the tenants. It's difficult for everybody, because you've had people where they couldn't be evicted. They didn't have to pay the rent. Now, there had to be criteria involved, which is fairly easy to overcome. And there's money involved in paying the landlords, assuming they fill out the paperwork properly and timely. Same thing with tenants, who there are programs to pay back rent. But those are fairly complicated. The paperwork is complicated. There's a statute of limitations. For example, October 1st of last year is when applications have to be put into place. And those people are protected beforehand, even though the money is not being paid, because the backlog is astronomical on this. So the law says that if you have applied and your application is pending, you can't be tossed and you don't have to pay the rent. Except if you haven't done the proper paperwork. And even if you haven't done the proper paperwork, you did not apply in time, the state's still not going to let you be evicted. Simply because, hey, we love tenants here. And the people who get nailed, I mean really nailed, are the mom and pop owners of these small apartment units, small buildings, or someone owns maybe 2-3 houses and is renting it out. I mean, they're screwed, because I tell you what the banks don't do when you owe a mortgage payment is they don't say, never mind, you don't have to pay. I mean, they'll foreclose. You don't pay, they'll give you notice, and then you're up for a foreclosure, and there's not a lot of protection. Now, there are programs that will pay you, and in cases of renters, there are programs that will pay 100% of the back rent. I mean, that's an enormous amount of money, but they're not easy to get. A lot are pending. The applications are difficult. There are timelines involved. And so let me tell you about Los Angeles. I love this one. Okay. Once the emergency period ends, that's the timeline. An emergency period, which at the earliest is going to be in June, at the earliest, but can be extended almost indefinitely. So once the city says, okay, emergency period is over, we're talking about the pandemic era, pandemic emergency, then you can start evicting. Until then, you're not going to. Well, again, so now instead of 1 year's rent, now it's becomes 2 years of rent the landlord is not collecting. So let's go back to $2,500 a month in rent, which in Southern California is not a lot of money. Two-bedroom apartment in a reasonable area of town. We're not talking about Beverly Hills. We're not talking about the great areas, Bel Air, Malibu. I mean, that's science fiction money. But we're talking about a nice area, $2,500 for a two-bedroom. That's not off base at all. Well, tell me not paying 2 years of that. Now, it's $50,000 the rent is owed the second the emergency is declared over. So in order for you to stay where you are, you could write a check for $50,000, except depending where you live. Some jurisdictions give you 6 months to pay. City of Los Angeles, once it's over, is going to give you a year to pay it off. And there's no interest and there's no penalty because there's obviously late payment. You ever rented? You know what I'm talking about. You're late a couple of days. You get hit with a late payment charge. That's all gone. And so the governmental programs are making it as easy as they can. But the pandemic has just wiped out so many people. And here is something else that's going on. This is where landlords are going crazy. If the state, if someone has not filed properly, has not filed, we're talking about tenants now, has not filed the paperwork properly, has not filed in time to forego the rent due right now to keep from being evicted, and the state supposed to dismiss those claims, they're not. State's not dismissing the claims. So in reality, those people who have not done it right, have applied wrongly, don't meet the criteria, haven't been affected by the pandemic and the way the rules are set up. Therefore, state by law has to dismiss. They're not willing to do it. State just won't do it. So it still remains just a god-awful mess, as you can imagine. I was telling you the story. As a matter of fact, I was telling all of us on the morning show this morning. I went into the break room over there, and occasionally people leave things. I mean, vendors will leave bags of corn chips or stuff. And there were a dozen cans of Mountain Dew Flaming Hot. Honest to God. Mountain Dew came out with sort of a flaming, like it's Cheetos Flaming Hot. And so we decided we're going to try it. Actually, it was Jen or Tyler decided that we were going to try it. So everybody took a little bit. First of all, it is basically radioactive orange is the color. And we all took a sip. And frankly, it's not nearly as bad as I thought it would be. Now, one of my teeth already fell out on the first sip. I get that. But Mountain Dew Flamin' Hot. Yeah, that's going to be a big seller, isn't it? All right, Dean Sharp, good morning.
Good morning, sir.
You have to get in line.
Speaking of orange soft drinks, you know, we just got back from Scotland.
Spending
a couple of weeks in Scotland. Iron Brew. Have you ever had Iron Brew?
I have not.
Iron Brew is the official soft drink of Scotland.
I didn't know that.
Bright orange.
Yeah.
And everybody thinks, oh, it's going to, you know, taste like orange soda. It's going to be a Fanta or something. No, it tastes like, probably the closest approximate. It tastes like bubble gum.
Oh, I thought it would
like
taste.
Really good bubble gum.
I thought it would taste like haggis. You're the only other human being I know that enjoys haggis. For those people that don't enjoy haggis, it's a national dish of Scotland. Goes back hundreds of years. It is a sheep's stomach. that is full of stuff, gruel and meats, and they boil it. It's
sweetbreads. It's full of sweetbreads.
Yeah, it's disgusting. Yeah, yeah. I like it.
Fantastic.
And I was told that by someone who went with you that you ate haggis at every turn.
Just about every day, every breakfast, yeah.
That's
for sure.
Yeah.
I love it.
I do too.
I love it.
And everybody's disgusted by it. All right, now, let's get to the topic at hand, and that is the new sexy. And it's not about us. It's about actually making your home sexy. And there are a lot of new ways of doing this. Now, you sent me a picture about how this works. And the first one that you have up there is a bathroom that has various different features. One of them, a walk-in shower, but I mean a walk-in shower, no little bumps or whatever. And then the toilet, it is a wall-mounted toilet, which are kind of neat because there's room underneath them for cleaning, et cetera, and they just look good. And it is a square toilet. Now, I have sat on square toilets. Unless you have a square ass, these are not the most comfortable toilets in the world, Dean.
Okay, well, I'm not promoting square toilets per se, Bill, okay? Oh, and by the way, what we're talking about is not just the new sexy. We're talking about accessibility. Sunday's show is about accessibility, making a home easier for aging in place or disability access in a home. And my point with calling it the new sexy is very simply that, you know, your home no longer has to look like some clinical retrofit with DIY ramps and stainless steel grab bars in order to be a really accessible place. In fact, if you are remodeling, you should give serious thought to the future in that regard, because most of the best accommodations right now for accessibility are simply part of the new design chic. I mean, they're just part of what makes a house these days really sexy, including, like you said, for instance, a curbless shower. I can count on one hand the amount of standard traditional shower pans we have had installed per our design and per the client in the last 10 years. All the rest, curbless shower. It's the new standard. And if you don't understand what that means, it simply means that there's no curb holding in the shower pan. There is a shower pan. It does slope. It does go down to the rain just like normal, but no curb to step over. The shower itself is a continuation of the bathroom floor.
I'm thinking a couple things. Effectively, what you're talking about is taking handicap features that used to be limited to handicapped people and realizing, you know, that's just a lot easier to deal with. Getting in the shower, dealing with, not so much the toilet. But
oh, the toilet, too. Yeah. Wall mount toilets are way more wheelchair and walker accessible than a footed toilet.
Okay.
And I don't know if you see in your notes there, but I showed you a little side diagram of a typical wall mount toilet set up there.
Yes.
One of the big keys about wall mount toilets is they take up less space in the bathroom because the tank, which normally is at least about 12 inches or so, before the bowl starts, the tank is inside the wall. So that means even, whether or not you have an accessibility issue, again, this is where it does kind of double dips. Whether or not you've got an accessibility issue, you've got more room in front of that toilet. And in a small bathroom, just more room in general,
yeah.
More visual room underneath and more room in front of the toilet.
Now, all kinds of questions about that. If the tank is in the wall, what happens if you need a new mechanism and it's falling apart? I'm assuming there's some kind of a door that you lift off.
Yeah. Okay. So
how do you get access to it?
Okay. First of all, the actual mechanism inside the tanks don't fail. They just don't fail. They're like a regular toilet tank. Tanks themselves, in other words, the reservoir, doesn't fail, and that's why it's safe to bury it inside the wall. Now, mechanisms like the flush valve and stuff like that, all of that, you see that diagram I give you, a tankless, or a wall mount toilet, has a big push button up above it, big square push button to activate the flush. You can remove that button and then reach down inside and access all the guts through the flush mechanism.
Okay. I'll buy that.
They're incredibly reliable.
Yeah, and
very,
real quickly, if you can do this in 30 seconds,
and
because we have to take a break and then come back, what if you weigh 300 pounds and you're sitting on a wall mount toilet? How does it not collapse under you?
They're incredibly strong, and they're weight rated, most of them, over 400 pounds.
Oh, okay. Let's say you're not going to spend that kind of money, but you want to just make it easier for yourself. Grab bars and even changing out your doorknobs. And the magic today are those levered doorknobs. There aren't those round doorknobs that are very difficult to open. You can do one of these with your elbow, which I do all the time when carrying packages. And they're gorgeous today. And it's not expensive to do, is it?
No, they're not. They're just, I mean, these aren't specialty items for accessibility issues. They're just a different style of hardware. But it has been proven, and every accessibility expert on the planet will tell you that, you know, even just us fully functional with, you know, non-arthritic hands, it's just easier, like you said, with an elbow or whatever, to open a door if you have a lever-type door hardware as opposed to an egg or a round knob that you got to grab onto, get a certain amount of friction on, and then turn. Especially if you're struggling with arthritis and other issues, levered door hardware throughout the house, it's an easy change-out. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that's sitting on the shelf at, you know, Lowe's and Home Depot and your local hardware store.
It's easy. And the let me give you a quick doorknob story. When I had a place in Hancock Park adjacent, it was a duplex that was built in 1927. We knew exactly when it was built. And we brought it back to an original 1927, like it was brand new. Boy, did that cost us some money. And it was a rental, but you don't keep those for rentals. You spend too much money. We had to find the round doorknobs that were the fake crystal, the kind they used to have in the 20s. Took us forever to find them.
Yes, glass knobs.
Yes, so difficult to open. And as you said, so much friction that, of course, when the Persian Palace was built, it was all levered doorknobs. And I'm assuming you go to Lowe's, you go to Home Depot, they're not that expensive.
No, they're not. They're not. They're simply another style. They sit right next to the round and the egg-shaped knobs in the same price range.
All right. So real quickly, I know we don't have that much time. Biometric locks, that's the retina eyeball where if someone wants to break in, they just gouge out your eyes like you'd see in all the movies, right?
No. No, this is just your fingerprint. I threw a few on here. Biometric locks, voice assistants, you know, things like Alexa and Siri and so on, and remote doorknobs, remote audio and video. I just threw all this all together because I want to encourage people that now is the time, you know, classically, right? Older folks are like, I'm not going to get into that newfangled high-tech stuff that she... No, now is the time to do exactly that, because high-tech smart homes, so many products, make life so much easier, especially if you are struggling with accessibility issues. The idea, for instance, I mean, Tina and I do it. We'll go to bed at night and we realize, did we turn off all the lights in the living room? I don't remember. And you know what? I don't get out of bed. I just say, hey, Siri, turn off all the lights in the living room, and kaboom, they're done, because our living room lights are controlled by our voice assistant. Biometric locks, instead of fumbling for keys, if you're having vision issues and trying to get a key and a load of groceries in your hands, biometric lock is just, you know, it's just a thumbprint, and boom, the deadbolt comes undone. It's so, that kind of stuff that you should be thinking about.
All right, so if you want to break in, you cut someone's thumb or finger off like they do
that
in the movies.
That is true.
And voice assistance, does the device have to recognize your voice? So if I want to break in, I hire a ventriloquist, or is it any voice?
No, you can choose either way. Anybody's voice or just yours.
I mean, that's pretty neat. And, of course, the Ring doorbell, how they are so inexpensive today, and everybody has them to the point where so many people have them. There's no such thing as a crime that's committed on the street or in a house where somebody isn't recording it with their Ring doorbell.
Exactly. And then there's the issue. Again, let's say you're having trouble getting up. You're in a chair. Maybe you're in a wheelchair, and maybe you're on the other side of the house, and boom, the doorbell rings. There's somebody at the door. Well, if you've got your phone near you, then all you have to do is open up that app, and you can make face-to-face contact. Well, their face to yours. They don't see you. Have a conversation with somebody at the front door without having to get all the way over to the front door.
Now, unlocking the door with your phone or at a distance, that's a different animal, isn't it?
It is, but there are locks that do that as well, especially the biometric locks can also, several of them also have Wi-Fi connectivity and, again, are able to lock and unlock on command.
How does that work? Is there a mechanism inside? I mean, there has to be some kind of a motor device that moves the lock back and forth.
There is. They're battery operated, but the batteries last a surprisingly long period of time. And there are even, for those folks who are like, well, I don't want to rebuild my whole door, there are biometric locks that control the deadbolt all by itself. And you can just retrofit these onto your existing deadbolt mechanism.
All right. What's on the menu this Saturday and Sunday for you? You got the show together yet?
Yeah, well, we're doing Sunday. We're talking accessibility. Not only accessibility at home, but we're also going to be talking about, for business owners, some business place accessibility and requirements that are going on these days. And Saturday's show, a bit of a grab bag. There are some things I got. Sunday's show was interrupted. We were talking about the water crisis, but we had a few press conferences. So there are some things on Saturday that I'm going to underscore about wildfires and drought that everybody needs to know.
Always good. Dean, thank you. We'll catch you over the weekend. At Home with Dean is his social address. Heard this Saturday, every Saturday, 6 to 8 a.m., Sundays, 9 a.m. to 11. And we're done. Tomorrow morning, it happens all over again, starting at 5 o'clock with Wake Up Call, Jennifer Jones-Lee. The rest of us come aboard at 6, and we end at right about now. Coming up, Gary and Shannon, Handel and the Morning Crew. This is KFI AM 640 live everywhere on the iHeartRadio app.